For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
The unsurpassed Good morning, everyone. It's a great privilege and honor for us to have with us giving the talk this morning, Dr. Stephen Hine. Unquestionably the most important Dogen scholar, at least in America, if not Japan. Oh, come on in. So, you can use that chair or that cushion. Stephen Hine is, amongst other things, professor at Florida International University, head of the Asian Studies Department or program. Also a very prolific author. I said he was the most important, at least American scholar of Dogen, and also one of the most important scholars about koans, which he's going to talk about today. So I wanted to say a little more about that. Stephen has produced countless, even he has trouble counting them, books, both his own books, over a dozen, and over a dozen books of edited volumes that he's contributed to that are collections of really fine works by other scholars. We go back to in Dogen and the koan tradition. I noticed a footnote about Bob Dylan, and we became friends after that. And in the mid '90s, co-wrote an article for a journal about Dogen and Dylan. So he's also a Dogen scholar of sorts, and has actually published one book, a Zen analysis of Dylan's career. Called Bargaining for Salvation, Bob Dylan Zen Master, ? He's done numbers of books on koans. His latest, just out, Zen Koans by Stephen Hine, which I haven't had a chance to, I haven't read all of his books, I have to confess, but quite a few. He's done anthologies, the koan, and also a book on the fox koan, which is very important in the Zen tradition. And I want to say a little more about his work on Dylan and about koans in general. Two of his books on Dogen are just, not on Dylan, on Dogen. His books on Dogen are very important. Two that I want to particularly mention, Dogen and the koan tradition, Which really revolutionized, for anyone who reads it, the view of koans that we have in American Zen, in addition to the idea of koans as koans are not paradoxical riddles. They're teaching stories. There's a whole body of literature that they are related to. But Stephen clarifies in Dogen and the koan tradition, the Soto, or Dogen approach to koans, which we follow here, which is, as Stephen has called it, the panoramic view or the scenic route of elaborating on koans, as Dogen did in one of his masterworks, Shobo Genzo, True Dharma, High Treasury. So it's a tremendously important book for all of American Zen. Also, in terms of Dogen studies, another book that's very important, Did Dogen Go to China? Is really a nuanced view of Dogen's career. So previously, Dogen scholars thought that there was an early Dogen and a late Dogen, and they contradicted each other, and there was a lot of nonsense about that, frankly. But Stephen's book Did Dogen Go to China? Goes through a nuanced view of his career and the stages of his career and how he was presenting various different kinds of teachings. So, at any rate, Stephen's been here a few times before, but I just wanted to say all that just because he's really a very, very important scholar and important to American Zen. And so I wanted to say that. And about koans, again, there Stephen's going to talk about a couple of koans today, but again, there's various different approaches, not just the curriculum of passing through koans, which is how most Americans think of Zen practice, of koan practice. But in Soto and in Dogen's tradition, there's huge commentary on koans in various different modes. So anyway, thank you. Sorry for that long introduction, but I really want people to understand the importance of your work. So thank you very much for being here, Stephen.
Thank you. Thank you, Dogen. And I'm always happy to be here. And I learned from Dogen's very profound understanding of Dogen and other materials. And I've been reading many times the translation he has with Shohaku Okumura, Dogen's extensive record, and I finally downloaded it to my Kindle, and I have it on my iPhone, and I can search and do all kinds of things on it, but it is very, you know, I one of my students also showed me I have a Zen app, a koan app. So there's a koan a day, and most of those aren't really koans, but if I contrast that with the Kindle version, it's so that's much more useful. And thank you for including the question marks in those titles so that there's no misunderstanding. May I ask you to? Yeah, I think there's enough copies. So these are a couple of cases from the most famous koan collection called Blue Cliff Record. And let me talk for a few moments about my own personal reflections on why the Blue Cliff Record is very important. And then I'd like to look at some of these cases in a little bit of detail, because I think there's some very interesting points we'll see in these two koans with commentary. The Blue Cliff Record, Hekigan Loku in Japanese pronunciation, Bien Lu in Chinese pronunciation. Speaking of Bob Dylan, you know, there's a line in the song called Brownsville Girl, and he introduces a character in this kind of offbeat narrative called Henry Porter, and he says the only thing we knew about Henry Porter was that his name wasn't really Henry Porter. And the name of the Blue Cliff Record is not really the Blue Cliff Record. But that's a small point, but it does highlight that this very spectacularly elaborate and eloquent collection of koan commentaries does have a mysterious and controversial early history. When I say that the title's not really Blue Cliff Record, the early manuscripts show that the title was Blue Cliff Collection rather than Record. And at some point, probably in the 1700s in Japan, that title got changed and that became the standard. And does it mean very much, that minor tweak? Probably doesn't mean too much. And whenever I say tweak these days, I make sure I don't say twerk, because it's... does that mean very much? Well, maybe not. I was talking to a Japanese scholar about this point, and they thought, the reason it was changed to Record was that it sounded more fixed, and collection sounds like it could be a more floating compilation of materials. And So if we go back to the word collection, we have to realize that the record that we have is kind of incomplete and has probably had a lot of materials left out or changed or modified over the years. That's one thing. Also, the color, blue. Now, in both Japanese and Chinese, there's a couple different characters that indicate that color, and there is a blurring of the lines between blue and green or emerald. And I think that the color they're really talking about is emerald. If you think of the cliffs and the greenery that you would see off in the distance in the cliffs in that part of China where this was composed, which was Hunan province, I think the color emerald is a little more accurate. On the other hand, we were driving past the lake and with a friend of mine yesterday, and the color of the lake was definitely blue, not green or emerald. Water and the greenery on mountains, you know, have to kind of go back and forth what color it is. But again, that's probably not a major item. What is a major item is that the Blue Cliff record was created in 1128, and it was apparently destroyed and lost for over 150 years in 1140, and it was destroyed by the creator's main disciple, who said it was useless and let's get rid of it. Now, we don't know, those are kinds of legends, and it's hard to recreate those materials, but there is that context. And because of that, partly because of that context, the history of it, even though it did get a great reception at other times, and it was recreated and reconstituted and revised and handed down over the years, and it is the subject of volumes and volumes and volumes of commentaries, dictionaries, reference works, etc. Because of that early controversy, I think it hasn't been taken quite as seriously, especially in recent Western studies. So Dogen's writing is no less difficult to read and translate, I think. Shobogenzo, Treasury of the True Dharma, is a very complicated work to make your way through, but there are a number of complete translations of it, and some of the chapters or fascicles of it have been translated over a dozen times. And whereas Blue Cliff Record, there's really only one complete, reliable translation, and that's by the Cleary brothers from 1977. And that was done in three paperback volumes at the time, and it was later reissued as a single volume, and that's available. And then Thomas Cleary, the better known of the brothers, did another version, but it's basically the same version. There's a few different differences, but still, I consider that there's one version and one variant. There's other materials available. I recommend the book Two Zen Classics by Katsuki Sekida, which also includes the Gateless Gate or Mumonkan, another important koan collection. And he's got some good interpretive materials. And that also came out, I think, in the late 70s. So that's available, but there's not much else out there that gets into it seriously. Again, if you look at Dogen or Rinzai, his record, or the Gateless Gate, the Mumonkan, those have been translated many, many times. So why not the Blue Cliff record? I think it's kind of haunted by this early history and this controversy. Now, talking about Dogen, there is also another controversy. There's a legend that Dogen, when he visited China in 4 years, in 1223 to 1227, that on the way back, he he made a copy of the Blue Cliff record in a single night. And according to that legend, a god appeared, and helped him because his hands got tired at about case 80, and they helped him write the last 20 cases, and then it was sent back to Japan. That's an interesting legend, but that would have taken place in the midst of the 150 years where they say that nobody was reading the Blue Cliff record because it had been destroyed before it was reconstituted. Now, it is conceivable that somehow Dogen fell upon a kind of secret copy, or there were copies of it around at some of the temples. But it's very unlikely. Why this foreign student who was only there for a few years, why would he have access to something that nobody else had. So that's one problem with the legend. And if you look at that legend, there's other problems. The legend did not come into existence for like 300 years after Dogen's death. And then the original deity that they talk about was a local Chinese water deity, because he would have been in a port town ready to sail back to Japan, and then it got changed to the deity near a Heiji temple in Japan. So, you know, that if you look at the legends, but then, you know, people look at the myths in all religious traditions, and we talk about demythologizing. What's the message behind the myth? But I've also thought recently about the word unproductive demythology, because if you demythologize, if you want to see the message under the myth, a lot of times you're taking for granted that the myth is still valid, but the details of it aren't important, so you want to get to the meaning. And that's true, but what if the myth itself is not valid because it was concocted at some point because of some sectarian agenda or to get across a view? I don't want to get too hung up on that stuff, but there is that atmosphere in the history of it. Now, when that translation came out in 1977, I was in graduate school, and I remember my PhD advisor called me up, you know, days before text messaging and emails. And so I had to make phone calls to communicate, and he called me up and he said, "Oh, this is out, you know, you have to get it and write to Random House and tell them you're going to use it in your class, and they'll give you a free copy." And which I did, dutifully, and I got it, and I couldn't make any sense out of it. And I said, "You know, I like everything about Zen but koans." and I put it away, and I put the three copies away in a box somewhere, and I was living in a, you know, kind of graduate student apartment style in Philadelphia. And then, you know, I go to that box later, and I see that there's cockroaches running all over it. You know, so I rescued those books, and I still have those books, and I still consult those books, but I was very resistant to it over the years. It's tough. And then when, you know, I heard the legend about it being destroyed, I go like, no wonder, it makes sense. And I'm hoping that, you know, I was also always a big fan of Franz Kafka, and, you know, he died as a fairly young, I think in his early 40s, and he told his best friend, "Please destroy my works after I'm dead." Unfortunately, the friend did not destroy them, but helped to propagate them. So, Taigen, please destroy, and I'll destroy you. If you die first, I'll destroy you.
Thank you.
And all, you got to destroy all the copies. That's harder to do these days than probably in Dahui's time.
Plus, you've got to get the Kindles.
Yes, that's right. You got to zap everybody, electronic version. And but, you know, I mean, one thing about, if you look at those legends, if that text was reconstituted in around 1300, it had to be reconstituted from something. So there was a version hanging around somewhere. In fact, they described that there were a couple different versions. And so it's, you know, it's the history is mysterious. But what about the meaning of the koans? Now, they talk about the seven-leveled construction of the Blue Cliff Record. So it's a very complicated construction. I think we can see this if we look at the handout and try to simplify it, or try to at least understand the significance of that construction. Now, to put that in historical context, let's go back to around 1000. And what was happening in Shan at that time? Well, the golden age of Chan, the heyday of Chan, when you had the famous masters like Mazu and Linji and Huangbo and Zhaozhou, and those are the Chinese pronunciations. You may be more familiar with the Japanese pronunciations, but most of the great masters that we think of were in the Tang Dynasty, especially in the 800s. And that was a period of spectacular developments in Chinese culture, especially Buddhist arts of different sects. But that was when Zen was first coming on strong. But it was still kind of a peripheral to the mainstream tradition. And then Chinese history got a little more complicated. There was a suppression of all forms of Buddhism for a few years by a fanatical emperor in the 840s. And then when Buddhism bounced back, somehow the Zen school started to become the mainstream. And by around 1000, Zen Buddhism, competing against other forms of Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, other kinds of cultural, intellectual learning at academies and other kinds of institutions. Of all, in that very competitive world, Zen started to become the dominant intellectual and cultural force in China around 1000. And they began to collect all these stories of dialogues, what they call encounter dialogues, that we now know as koans, around that time. And there were dozens of texts being produced around that time, collecting them. Usually they were built around the life story of a particular person. And they say, this guy, you know, was born here, he studied under this master, and these are the anecdotes and sayings and doings of that of his life. And then he died, and usually he wrote some poetry when he died. A lot of times there's some kind of miraculous event around his death, and then they go, and then he left these students, and then they tell you about those students. So that's the way the koans were generally referred to. But then they began to comment, assess, evaluate the koans by writing poetry. So in the Blue Cliff Record, we see that there's something called case. Like if you look on the first page, it says case, or sometimes it's called the main case. And that's the koan. That's the dialogue that becomes known as the koan. And then we see some comments around it. I'll come back to those in a minute. But if you turn over to the next page on 272, you see verse. So there's koan and verse. And then if you look at the verse, how many lines are there in the verse? Four main lines, right? Okay, that's not an accident. So that was a poetic style that was popular in China at the time among what they call the scholar officials or the literati, the well-educated Chinese intellectuals were always writing poetry. And a very common form was to write four lines. Earlier in China, there had been eight lines or a longer version, and that was still being done. But you know, in Japan, they have the haiku, which is 17 syllables, right? And before that, there was the waka, which was 31 syllables. So there was a, over the history, the 31 syllables became shortened or abbreviated into the 17 syllables. There's this emphasis on kind of minimalism or getting it down, abbreviating to the essence. And in the Chinese poetry, something similar. They went from longer structure to eight lines and then four lines. And the four lines have to be structured in a certain way. Usually they have seven Chinese characters. There's rhymes and other rules and regulations for how to write them. And they're supposed to have a certain progression of the images, where the first line makes a statement, the second line continues the statement, the third line contradicts the first two, and the fourth is a kind of a paradox or comes to some kind of conclusion, or not, or an inconclusive conclusion. You know, and that was in the poetry. It wasn't necessarily Zen, but it was very Zen-like perspective by looking at the contradictory, ambiguous worldview and then coming up with some insight that didn't try to resolve it in terms of a neat package, but gave you a spontaneous understanding of the nature of the inconclusiveness and ambivalence embedded in that experience that the poem is talking about. And the poem was written in 1038 by one monk to make comments on the verses. So if you know, one way to read these is to just go for the case and the verse. That's what you would have had from 1038 to 1128. So for those 90 years between the original structure, which was case and verse only by one monk, and then the Blue Cliff Record, which comes, you know, almost a century later, which adds more levels to it, you know, you had a much simpler structure. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, the rationale for destroying this Blue Cliff Record was, let's go back to that simple structure. You know, it's hard enough. The koans are puzzling and perplexing, and then these comments have a lot of allusions to Chinese folklore and mythology and earlier kinds of poetry, and how do you make sense of it all? So let's go back to that simple structure. And I do recommend, you know, a lot of times just look at case and verse, and you will see still example additions of that. Like if you had editions produced in China today, where there's a huge revival in the last 10, 15 years of Zen Buddhism and rebuilding of some of those old temples that had been destroyed and the Cultural Revolution are coming back now, you will see editions produced of just case and verse. You know, and I visited last summer, I visited the temple where these were supposedly first composed back in 1038. And it was interesting because at that temple today, they're known for doing social work and outreach, and they had a big gold Maitreya Buddha statue. And they had a lot of discipline and practice, but it didn't really seem like Zen meditation exactly. And I said, well, what's your view of these old case and verse? And they said, oh, we don't pay too much attention to that. And then I noticed in one of the pamphlets they gave me, there was an example of it in calligraphy form, very stylized kind of calligraphy. And I said, well, you know, you have this example here. And they said, oh, we just have a calligraphy contest. We don't really study it for the content. I don't know if that was true or not, but you know, a lot's changed over the years. On the other hand, people do take it seriously in both China and Japan. But anyway, the core of it is the case and verse. And then what happens? Well, then in the 1120s, the second guy comes along and he adds five kinds of comments. So there's what's called here the pointer, which is kind of an introductory remark. It's not usually specifically on the case, but usually it talks about what Zen insight is like and what a Zen master should be like in a more general sense. And then after the case, you see it says notes. These are often called capping phrases. And these are kind of short, ironic comments, interjected. And the way they put it in this translation is you see the case and then notes one and two. Why are there notes? Why are there two notes, do you think? If you look at the case, why are there only two notes? Like, if we look at it at the next case, if you go over to, and flip over to the second page, there's going to be seven notes. So why this one only has two? Very simple point. It has two because there's only two sentences, two main sentences in that case. So these notes or capping phrases are done for each sentence. So if there's seven sentences, there'll be seven. If there's ten, but a lot of the koans are quite short because it's a very abrupt exchange that takes place. And some of the koans have longer discussions or narratives, or there's more back and forth. So looking at the Blue Cliff record, 100 cases, I said to myself, you know, there's the short, abrupt ones, and then there's the longer ones. I'm calling the short, abrupt ones puzzlers, for want of a better word, because they deliberately leave you with inconclusiveness. And then I'm calling the longer ones dazzlers, because there's a lot of back and forth that kind of, now which one is easier to understand or not understand, you know, it depends quite a bit. But I wanted to pick these two examples, cases 45 and 46, because the first one's a puzzler and the second one's a dazzler. And the first one has a very short, abrupt dialogue. And when I added up, when I went through that list and I said, I don't want to have any assumptions, so let me just go one by one and give that my label just to see. And by the end, it was 50-50. I'm sure, you know, you didn't quite think of it that way. But some of the Zen masters are known for what they call the one word or one phrase barriers. And Jiaozhou, also in Joshu in Japanese pronunciation, is one of those. So he's got 12 cases out of the 100. And usually he gives a very, very brief response to something. And this is one of the famous ones where they say, Jiaozhou was known for saying the myriad things, or all phenomenon go back to oneness. Where does that oneness go back to? And somebody asked him about that, and he says, when I was in Qingzhou, I made a cloth shirt. It weighed 7 pounds. So that's what I'm calling a puzzler. Now, probably the single most famous puzzler, it's a little bit similar. It's a monk named Dongshan. Not the Dongshan that Taigen's next book is about, who's the founder of the Soto school in China, but another monk named Dongshan, who's also not quite as famous. And he says, there's a question to him, what is the Buddha? And he says, 3 pounds of, you translate as sesame, I think, right? 3 pounds of sesame is a good translation. It could be, you also see flax, and it could be cloth. And it's interesting because why 3 pounds of cloth? Well, usually the interpretation is given is that's what it took to to construct a robe. But if you look at that case, they'll say, well, many of you are going to read this and sit and think to yourself, that's what it, you know, 3 pounds of flax. And as soon as you think that, of course, that's wrong. Don't think that at all. And that's a pattern that builds up. So why does he talk about the cloth shirt weighing 7 pounds? Well, apparently, the town that he refers to is known for producing cloth shirts. Well, if you think that, forget it. You're wrong. I mean, that's not what it's about. They say it. And they're going to say that no matter what you think. So any interpretation you have, he's out here to refute it. You know, if you read these comments carefully, he kind of pretty much anticipates and picks apart one by one any assumption that you're going to come to. But anyway, let's go back to the structure. So the second guy adds the introduction or pointer. He adds the notes or capping phrases. Each line of the case has one of these. Then he adds what they call commentary. That's prose. That's in prose discussion. Now, this guy who wrote this was a great poet himself. He had his own collection of verses. But in the Blue Cliff Record, he only contributes one verse. It's in case 100. And he says, you know, after having wasted all your time with my comments here, you know, I'm going to regretfully write one more verse. And he has that kind of tongue-in-cheek, self-deprecating attitude. Okay, and then on the next page we see there's a verse. Now here they follow the pattern that you would see more in the original Chinese, where the notes or the capping phrases are done right after each line. So there's 4 lines, there's 4 capping phrases. You see some of them are a little longer than others. It does depend on how he, you know, what came to his mind. And then there's more prose commentary. So if you add it all up, there's 7 sections. There's the case and verse, that's 1 and 2. There's the capping phrases on case and verse, that's 3 and 4. There's the intro, that's 5. And then there's the prose comments on case and verse. And, you know, it gets kind of complicated. And why does he add so many comments? So let's take a look at the first capping phrase on that case. A monk asked Jiaozhou, the myriad things return to one, where does the one return to? He's pressing this old fellow. So why does he say he's pressing this old fellow? Well, it seems to be a way of complimenting the questioner. That's, you know, you got this famous master here, you're really giving him a hard time, that's good. You know, you should challenge him. He deserves to be challenged. See if he can come back and give you a good answer. So that's a form of praise, it seems like. He should avoid going to the ghost cave to make his living. Well, it's hard to know whether that's praise or not. He should avoid going to the ghost cave. Is he stuck in the ghost cave? That would be an insult. That would be a zinger. But is he avoiding it successfully? That would be a form of praise. So in other words, some people talk about these capping phrases kind of a scorecard. And he tells you how the dialogue is going. Except they're very ambiguous because he might chalk up somebody in the W column for win and then also put him in the loss column at the same time. And so if you're trying to keep track, he's probably not going to give you a conclusive answer. And that's the pattern that's going to be set up. So the koans themselves are not conclusive. And then his comments add to the uncertainty that's building up on different levels. But, you know, is there a point to all that? Or is it just mind games and word games that deserve to be incinerated by his follower? Okay, so let's look at the second column of that page. In the middle of there, it says, one day a monk asked Jiaozhou, and would anybody like to read that paragraph? Okay.
One day a monk asked Jiaozhou, what is the meaning of the patriarch coming from the west? Zhao said, the cypress tree in the garden. The monk said, don't use objects to teach people with, teacher. Zhao said, "I've never used objects to teach people. Observe how, at the ultimate point, where it is impossible to turn, he does turn and spontaneously covers heaven and earth. If you can't turn, wherever you set foot on the road, you get stuck."
Okay, great. All right, so there's two main points. There's the dialogue and then his comment. So let's take a look at the dialogue. This is one of the most famous stories about Jiaozhou or Zhoushu, and it's also included as a separate koan in the Gateless Gate collection. Here, even though there's 12 Jiaozhou koans in the Blue Cliff record, and Jiaozhou was known for a lot of things. He's known for the famous koan where a cat cuts in two, and in response he put his sandals on his head and walks away. And that's in there. But this one is not in there as a separate koan, but it does appear in this commentary. And part of the aim of there is to kind of build up more stories about Jiaozhou. So as I said, there were, another genre of text that just talked about these dialogues in the context of the life story of a particular guy. So probably what this author has done is going back to that resource of, you list all these dialogues and we have Jiaozhou. So let's bring in a couple of other examples to kind of flesh out what this guy is like and get to know him a little better. And that's, it's partly, probably it's that simple to some extent, but then he tries to make a very important point here. Now, if you know that dialogue, if you've seen that in other contexts, there's a little bit more complicated version of it. So I would call this version, what do I call it? A puzzler. But it is a kind of dazzler if you look at the fuller dialogue, because there's another comeback to it that takes place. Anybody familiar with that one? Okay, so what happens in the longer version is that when he says cypress tree in the garden, and sometimes you see oak tree, but I think Taigen and I agree it should be cypress tree. But I think we also agree it should be courtyard rather than garden. But not, those are fine points. But anyway, the monk says, well, do not teach us with objects. So don't just point to some external object and teach me. I want to know the internal truth. And he said, I've never used objects to teach people. And it stops here, but in the longer version, he says, well, then what is the meaning of the patriarch coming from the West? And Jiaozhou says, cypress tree in the courtyard. So in the longer version, he comes back and repeats the thing. And that's a pattern that we see in a lot of the koans, that if a question is posed, the question is answered by repeating the question. Or if an answer is given if the master's asking the question and somebody gives an answer, the master may repeat it back to him. And it seems like it's not getting very far, but obviously through that interchange, some vision of the truth or some experience of Satori is supposed to emerge. Now, let me use the term Satori for a second. That's the term that's often used to refer to the instantaneous flashes of insight. And the word Satori was kind of made famous by T.T. Suzuki in modern times. It was always around in the Zen discourse, but it's kind of taken on a new life in the 20th century, I think, the idea that, okay, there's these moments of insight. They may be fleeting. You may need a series of them to have true enlightenment, but you can't get the enlightenment without these moments. And I think the term in the West that would be similar would be epiphany, which is a term that I've looked into recently, and the novelist James Joyce seems to have really kind of invented the modern meaning of that term, pulling it out of traditional Catholic theology, where it referred to the second coming of Jesus, and it was very theological term that he used. But if you go back to the early Greek, that term referred to like the moment you start to see the dawn. That's an epiphany. Or referred to if you're waiting in battle and you see the opposing troops coming over the hill, that moment, that's an epiphany. Or if you're doing a ritual in a shrine in ancient Greece, and the ritual you feel like makes the god or goddess appear in the wall of the temple, that's an epiphany. So in a way, that flavor is true here. Like, out of this ordinary conversation, something something emerges and you get the vision. Now, in this, going back to the, so one of the things that the author of the Blue Cliff Record says, that has been picked up on by some of his later followers, was before Satori, well, let's put it this way. Two things are very important: meaning or intent of an expression and the words in the expression. So which is more important? So he says that before Satori, anybody know that or guess what he might have said? Which would be more important, the meaning or intent or the words? Before Satori, which is more important? Yeah.
The meaning.
Meaning, right. Why is that?
Well, because you don't know the meaning. I mean, you're looking for the
meaning. You're looking for the meaning, and you don't want to get distracted by the words. The words may just be verbiage that's a distraction, so you're trying to pull out the meaning. So after Satori, the words are important, not the meaning. Why would that be? So after Satori, then you're you're not the student anymore, you're the teacher. So from the teacher's standpoint, coming up with the right words is what's important, and not the meaning, because you know that there's no real meaning to any particular words. You're just using words that are relevant to answering the question as skillful means. You're using words in the context relevant to that corresponds to the appropriate context of the student that you're dealing with. So in that sense, the words are important because you're trying to target your words appropriately to that context, and the meaning's not important post-Satori because there is no meaning. You know, whether you say the 3 pounds of cloth or the 7-pound shirt or whatever the answer is going to be, post-Satori, you realize there's no real meaning in that word. It's the way the person said it at the time. So the next sentence in that paragraph, I think, gets to the heart. If there's one sentence that sums up the entire teaching of the Blue Cliff Record, I think that sentence, and I like the way you... Would you read that sentence again?
Observe. Observe how, at the ultimate point where it is impossible to turn, he does turn, and spontaneously covers heaven and earth. If you can't turn, wherever you set foot on the road, you get stuck.
Okay, so according to this scorecard keeping, so to speak, where he's analyzing the winners and losers of the exchange, not that there really are winners and losers, because both parties are trying to bring each other, you know, trying to elevate each other. It's not a competition in the ordinary sense, but it does borrow, a lot of times they do borrow kind of military imagery from art of war rhetoric that was being used, and they talk about the double-edged sword quite a bit—the sword that gives life and the sword that kills—and they, you know, a lot of times there is that combative imagery there. But I don't think the point is that, you know, somebody wins and loses. That's not what it is. But there's also a scorecard keeping in the sense that somebody's getting closer than somebody else. So either the disciple has gotten very close or has gotten an insight, has gotten a satori, and is a step closer to enlightenment, or the master has shown his ability and facility with using the words appropriately to the needs of that disciple as a master, we have to give him credit for using the right kind of teaching in that context. And so what's the author's comment on Zhaozhou here? Is he good, or is he a winner or a loser? Using those words, not literally.
Clearly, winner.
Okay, and because what's the proof?
Because he's able to use words despite not using words or objects.
Right. Right. At the ultimate point where it is impossible to turn. So it looks like he's backed into a corner and has nowhere to turn. It looks like finally the disciple has gotten the best of him. It's a kind of gotcha moment from the disciple. And the teacher is exposed. So in these encounters, you know, both sides are exposed in a sense. You know, there are always some simple, deceptively simple question answered. Not always, but a lot of times it starts with this, you know, what is the Buddha? What is the meaning of the patriarch coming from the West? What is Buddha nature? Who are you? Where do you come from? They start with these kinds of questions that kind of open the door for the person to reveal themselves. And both parties are revealing themselves, the teacher and the student. And at the ultimate point where it's impossible for him to turn, he does turn. And so, you know, if we put a label on it, it could be something like turnabout Zen. And the turnabout Zen means that the teacher demonstrates the flexibility to adjust on a dime, to adjust spontaneously that's in accord with the needs of that moment. And of course, one basis of the success of the teacher would be how well the student is doing. We don't know for sure how well the student would respond to this, but the assumption would be that it's not just that he's saving face for himself that he's made this turn, but that it's becoming a role model for the student, so that the student will be elevated and will reach his own satori. Okay, so let's take a look at the verse comment. And here I want to make a little bit of a remark on the translation, which I think is basically very good, but you could always tweak it a little bit here and there. And I think the first line of the verse is a little needs an adjustment, a simple but important adjustment. So he wraps everything up and presses against the ancient old all. A WL or gimlet, which is, you know, a device to kind of make a small hole in a piece of wood that's being used in for some construction. So the awl is a tool that's used. He wraps everything up and presses against the ancient old awl. So who's wrapping up and who's pressing, according to this?
It's the monk. And Jojo is the hall.
Right, okay, that's good. But that's not totally obvious here. In other words, I think you're right there. In other words, the all refers to the person, not the instrument. So Jojo is being referred to as an all or a gimlet. In other words, because he's an expert at using devices, he's being referred to by that term. So, but wraps up is a little bit unclear because the monk does, you know, the monk who's asking the question can't wrap it up because otherwise he'd be the teacher. So I think a little better translation would be, you know, he's investigating and he presses the old ancient teacher, right? That's the capping phrase. If we go back to the capping phrase to the case, he's pressing this old fellow. So he's pushing him to the corner. And even though that teacher is a gimlet or an awl, that means that he's got the ability to be an expert technical, you know, to use expert techniques in teaching. And if you look at the prose commentary, it refers to a different commentator on Koan's Funyang. He had 18 kinds of questions. Well, that's why, you know, this is a place where it starts to get very complicated. So, or one of the many places it gets complicated. He had 18 kinds of questions. Now, Funyang was one of the early commentators in the koans, and he's known for a list. He said there's 18 kinds of koans. And if you look at, you know, some of the other peoples, they would say, you know, like Taigen's book on the five ranks, right? But the five is not just five. Because you have to look at variations and gray areas. So there's a lot of different categories. It becomes these very complicated systems. Now, if you were a monk back then reading this, or a well-educated literati reading this who knew a lot about Zen, oh, okay, you go like, yeah, that's right. You know, I know I have that at my fingertips. I know those 18 questions. Now I see it. That's, out of these 18 questions, this is, I think, I looked this up, I think it was number 5. I don't have the 18, you know, in my head constantly to get the whole point here, but that's why it gets, you know, that's one of the areas where it starts to get very complicated, because there's references to things that they, back then they could take for granted the readership knew, and that knowledge has been, you know, lost over the years, or at least we have to, if we have that knowledge, we're going to have to pull out the reference books, get our Kindle apps going, and check this stuff. But okay, so let's take a look at the rest of the poem. How about lines 2, 3, and 4? Anybody read those?
How many people know the weight of the 7-pound shirt? Right now I throw it down into West Lake, the pure wind of unburdening. To whom should it be imparted?
Okay. So, as I mentioned earlier, the first line of the poem is supposed to kind of make an opening statement. The second line is supposed to take it a little bit further. Third is a something contradictory, and the fourth tries to bring the paradox to a kind of harmonious conclusion, even if the harmonious conclusion means that it's no conclusion at all, because there is no fixed answer. Okay, so in the first line, the monk is pressing against the master, which is a good thing, because that shows that the monk has, you know, it's kind of spunky and has his own sense of savvy and skill in knowing a good question to raise. And the second line implies, well, the master, he did a pretty good job by talking about the 7-pound shirt, because he disarmed the questioner and he answered him indirectly, and that's the best thing to do, because you don't want to take the words too literally, and you're trying to get the precatory person to get the meaning. So to get to the meaning, let's change up the wording here, because otherwise he'll think that the words have the meaning. The words don't have the meaning. The meaning is inside him, and so he's got to realize, kick off the meaning, you know, and turn on that light switch inside. And so let's use words that don't really have any meaning. That's why you can't think about the meaning. He'll say, if you read this closely, like, don't think about it, you know, that town has beautiful shirts or something, because then you're getting distracted by some meaning that's irrelevant. So don't think about meaning, but it forces you to have an internal, hopefully insightful, reflexive reaction. Okay, the third line, after the first two lines, what does the third line seem to suggest?
Throw the whole thing away.
Yeah, throw the whole thing away. So don't get, you know, I, the commentator on this dialogue, this poet is you know, a century, about 150 years later, I guess, you know, he's saying, like, okay, I'm not going to get hung up on it either way. The best thing is to cast it off. You know, Dogen has the famous saying, cast off body mind. This is a perfect example that in the Zen tradition, I'm going to throw it into the West Lake. I've tried to look into, okay, where was that West Lake exactly? Because there's a very famous West Lake in China, but that's not it. There was some other lake. But then I realized, hey, wait a second, it doesn't really matter which lake it was. But he was probably in a temple, you know, where there was a lake nearby. Although at the same time, I was surprised that the Japanese scholars, who have all these footnotes and they track all these things, didn't really have an answer to that one. But it was probably some. But anyway, he's throwing it away. He's throwing it away into nature. You know, let the water flow, and we can discard it. Then the next line, I would tweak the translation a little bit. The pure wind of unburdening, to whom should it be imparted? That's pretty good. The thing is, the wind here doesn't really, in my reading of it, doesn't really mean wind in the physical sense, although it could, but it refers to the style. The term wind is often used to refer to the style. So it's like, the Chan style is to unburden. The Chan style is to cast off. But who's going to really understand that? By the time this poet has cast it off, you know, by the time I've cast off, can people really understand that? So if I cast off, if we discard these stories, it's kind of warning the people who are going to come along and destroy this text later. If you destroy it, what's left? You know, if we go back to the prose commentary, we come to, on the first page, you know, the age-old, in the first main paragraph, where it says, a monk asked Xiaozhou, a couple lines below that, if you go to the words to discriminate, you are mistakenly abiding by the zero point of the scale. If you don't go to the words, that's the dilemma. That's the double-edged sword that they always come back against. And so, there's a line that I like, and I think it's in the pointer to case 25, where they say if your words don't startle the crowd or astonish the crowd, you're just very commonplace. Then you're just a commonplace speaker or orator or writer. So you know the words have to be stimulating to get people's attention. But you don't want to get hung up on the words. Now, I don't know how much time we have left.
Not so much, because we want to have some time for discussion.
Okay.
So
maybe
10 minutes or so.
Okay.
We're not going to have temple cleaning today, by the way, so there's a little more time.
All right, thank you. So let's take a look at the second case that I have here. This is what I call a dazzler. Okay. So, like on this one, how about if someone is the Jing Qing, would be the pronunciation, who's the master. And Jing Qing is known, in case 16, he's known, and other people have used that metaphor, but he's known for using the metaphor of the mother hen and the chick inside the shell, and they're both pecking at the shell to break it down. So that's the master-disciple relationship. And he's famous for that metaphor, that imagery, although others have used that. And that imagery is often referred to, and if you look at the column 2 here, where it says in the paragraph beginning in varying places, that is sometimes referred to as a process of tempering. And I think what they mean by the tempering is like when, you know, in the old days when they make the sword. Again, this, you know, the martial imagery is very important. So if you make a sword, the tempering process of the sword would be to get that metal to be razor sharp. You have to go through different steps, you know, heating it, cooling it off, thinning it out, and getting it so that the sharpness is going to prevail and be preservable for generations afterwards. That process was often compared to the process of the master training the disciples. And then, of course, he says, in various places they call these tempering words, but if it were tempering, it would only amount to mental activity. So don't think of it as tempering words, because as soon as you're going to think of it as something, he's going to tell you you shouldn't think of it that way. But at the same time, most people who commented on it back then said this was an example of tempering. And that process of tempering, you know, it's one of the things that as these documents have come down to, you know, and we've been inheriting the Zen sayings from back then, almost 1,000 years ago, that's not one of the ones that's I think is so well known. That's kind of gotten lost in the shuffle given other things that have been prioritized or highlighted or emphasized. But, you know, looking into it, you know, I find that this was something back then they kind of took for granted, like the guy's 18 questions, the tempering words. These were categories of ways of dealing with this stuff that they took for granted. People knew and had that, at the, you know, in the top of their mind. So when they referred to it, you would know exactly what he meant. We were looking at it now. It's like, well, what the heck does that mean, tempering words? You know, we can imagine. I'm not sure the answer I gave about the sword is completely correct either, because that we don't, you know, if there were descriptions of it, they don't seem to be available anymore. Maybe they got lost, or maybe they never bothered to write down the descriptions because it was taken for granted back then that people would know what that meant. I guess it was an oral transmission and it never entered into the written word. But let's look at the dialogue. So let me ask if somebody would play the role of Jing Qing, and I'll be the monk. Okay, thank you.
Okay. What sound is that outside the gate?
The sound of raindrops.
Sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things.
Well, what about you, teacher?
I almost don't lose myself.
What is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself?
Though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult.
End of the matter. So this is what I would put in the Dazzler category. Okay, and Taigen has a section on this in the Zen Questions book. And also Dogen refers to this in the Dogen's extensive record book. I think it's volume 1, number 39, because I checked my Kindle recently. And Dogen also has a Japanese poem about this. And, you know, the big question is, well, what, to me, I mean, is, you know, what is the sound of the raindrops? Is that a meaningful thing or it's not a meaningful thing? In the past one, the 7-pound shirt is meaningful in the sense that that was the final answer to the monk's question, the cypress tree in the courtyard. So the very concrete, specific thing of external reality. And then in the cypress tree, they say, don't just teach me out of external reality. But still, we're just left with this external reality. Now, if they're in the the temple or in the master's abbot's quarters, let's say, where a lot of these dialogues would have taken place, in the rainy season and in the typhoon season, you know, it's very likely that outside there's a driving rain. And would it be a good thing if you were keeping score? Would that be a good thing or not a good thing to say the raindrop sounds? I mean, what would be the argument that is a good response?
Well, yes. Those words are accurate. They reflect the reality.
They reflect the reality, right? And probably if it's a driving rain out there, probably no matter what we're saying, we're hearing those sounds. We're immersed in that sound. That sound is kind of overtaking all our perception. So that would seem to be just as good as an answer, a 7-pound shirt. But, well, we got to know that, hey, this is the monk and the man, that's the master, so it can't be that great, probably. Or else, the dialogue would have been recorded differently. And it's interesting when you look at these dialogues in different versions, because sometimes the masters are, you know, it's usually master-disciple, but a lot of times it's master-master. And if you look at the dialogue in the record of one master, guess what? He comes out on top. You look at the same dialogue in the other record of the other one, and the roles are sort of reversed here. All right. So the sound of raindrops. Now, sentient beings are inverted. That word inverted can also be upside down, backwards, topsy-turvy. And that word is used a lot in this Blue Cliff record, actually, because it can be a noun, it can be a verb that's used in different ways. So a lot of times one of the cabin phrases is overturn his meditation seat, meaning, did you ever feel that way? okay, you know, but a master can overturn Mount Sumeru, which is the mythical cosmic mountain in Buddhism. So if you're a master, you can overturn Mount Sumeru. If you're a disciple that's a stubborn non-learner, not making progress, you're going to get your meditation seat overturned. So a lot of times that same word is used in that kind of way. It can have a very positive meaning. They talk about, there's in case 86, it says you should sit on the ox and ride it backwards into the Buddha shrine. Now, is that good to ride it backwards or not? Well, probably it was a very good thing, because there was a famous story about a hermit at that time who lived up in the mountains, and when he would have to go into the village to get supplies, he'd ride backwards so he could see the mountain the whole time. And, you know, if he was good enough to steer the ox riding backwards, that's probably pretty powerful. At the same time, it's kind of ridiculous, so we don't really know that it's that high a compliment. But the other thing about the word inverted was that it was used in early Buddhism to basically mean wrong, erroneous, mistaken view, ignorance. It really is a symbol, synonym for ignorance until Zen gets hold of it and starts to use it in positive as well as negative ways. But in this context, it means, look, sentient beings are invariably deluding themselves. and they're chasing after external things. So don't tell me about the sound of the rain. I hear the sound of the rain. I don't need you to tell me the sound of the rain. You know, tell me something that shows your insights. Now, probably if he'd said something that showed his internal insight, the guy would have said, why don't you tell me about the sound of the rain? That's the only important thing here. And so he, you know, this guy, this monk, though, is pretty pretty spunky, and he says, well, what about you? Now, I almost don't lose myself. Now, that's another one that's tricky to translate. The word almost, and I don't know if they do this deliberately or not, but if you look up that the Chinese character for almost, it can also mean, it does mean almost, but it can also mean soaked.
Can mean what?
Soaked. Which would be very, you know, very interesting if it, if the, I got to assume that they wanted to have that kind of wordplay in your mind. And it's kind of very difficult to put that in the translation because grammatically it wouldn't make, it doesn't really make sense the way the position of it in the grammar, but you want to have that in mind. But also, I almost don't lose myself. Now, that might give an impression that he's about to lose himself, but he doesn't quite do it. And I think, and you know, trying to look at the grammar of that sentence, I think a little better translation is, a little more accurate translation is, until now, I didn't lose myself. In other words, he's acknowledging your question is pretty tough and I'm about to lose myself now. Until now, I thought I was pretty safe. But, you know, you can argue for the different translations. I just point out these small tweaks to clear. He does a phenomenal job, but there's always room to explore some other possibilities. Okay, well, what's the meaning of I almost didn't lose myself or until now you didn't lose yourself? Well, you know, what the heck does that mean after all? You know, so did you or didn't you lose yourself? Though it should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. And the expression in the first part of it, to express oneself, well, that's an idiom. At the time, that meant somebody who could express themselves was somebody who passed the entrance exams. You know, the imperial exam system in China, very severe, harder than our, I don't know, in Florida we have what they call the FCATs. You must have something in Illinois, some standardized testing that all kids have to go through these days, right, before you get to the SATs. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. So the passing the exam, it was a metaphor for passing the exam. And the idiom would always say, passing the exam is hard. Passing the exam is never easy. They would always say, passing the exam is hard. Study with us. We'll, you know, for a cheap price, we'll get you through it. So to say it's easy is quite, you know, an interesting inversion, you know. And then, but to say the whole thing must be difficult. So what's the difference between... again, you can argue, I don't want to get too hung up on quibbling about the translation, but let's just stick with what we got on the paper here. To express oneself is easy, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. What would be the difference? Where would you draw the line? What would be more difficult? What do they mean, one's difficult and one's easy?
Well, maybe if you're expressing oneself, that's sort of inherently expressing a sort of a partial, one-sided kind of view, where it's expressing it all.
Yeah.
And putting yourself in context, that broader context.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So express yourself is going to be the partial one-sided. So whether you say sound of raindrop or whether you would say something more internal, it's still going to be one-sided. And even the master here is realizing the one-sidedness of whatever he's going to say. That's why these dialogues are a little more complex. I'm not saying they're better, but they have a certain interesting quality because you can see more back and forth. It's not just winner takes all, so to speak, like in the first dialogue where, okay, Jiao Shou prevails. Here, he admits his own the own challenge, and he doesn't give us a final answer, really. And so expressing the whole thing is what is difficult. So let's turn to the poem, and then I'll wrap it up there, and we can have some questions. An empty hall, the sound of raindrops, hard to respond even for an addict. Okay, so the poem is saying Jing Qing is a hard time. Even though he's an adept, he's a master, it's hard to respond to this whole issue about the raindrops. If you say he's ever let the streams enter as before, you still don't understand. Understanding or not understanding, on South Mountain, on North Mountain, more and more downpour. So, as I said, in these four-line verses, and here it looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but they've actually spread them out. It's actually 4 in the original. Because I think 1 and 2 are actually 1 line in the original. But that, in any case, the idea of the last line would be the cap-off line. The last line would give you the final kind of capping phrase effect, the final kind of paradoxical image, often based on something naturalistic, like we had the West Lake was mentioned before, the lake, you know, throwing into the lake. Here we have the mountains. So what does this image convey?
Soaked.
Soaked, okay. In a word, yes, exactly. Very good. Very good. So, from north to south, I don't think he's referring to any particular mountain here. He just means, you know, from north to south, from east to west, the whole thing is soaked. You know, there's more and more downpour. It's interesting that it doesn't quite, you know, it's not referring to a specific rain. The rain's coming, the rain's going. It's just like a constant downpour throughout. And so in that sense, it implies that, hey, we should kind of lose ourselves. He says people are inverted. They lose themselves in the external. But I think the poem is saying, well, look, if you lose yourself appropriately in the external, you know, then you get that emergence. Then you get the whole thing. Now, who's going to make that judgment? Well, we're going to have the last guy come along to tell us. And on the bottom of 278 there, it's interesting because usually if you look at a lot of these, like if you look at back on the first page on at the bottom of 273, the final comment on case 45, he says, go back to your places and look into this. In other words, I'm not going to give you an answer, and the poet wasn't right, nothing was right, so you figure it out for yourself. It's like, we can say this, I can say this, they can say this, I can comment on what they said, but in the end, you figure it out. But here, he doesn't say that, and that's the pattern. If you look at 100 of those cases, most of them in that pattern of, like, you decide. But here, he just repeats the image. So I think, you know, the way I interpret it is, like, that image is powerful enough, so he doesn't have anything to add to it. And even to add to it, like, you figure it out, because there's nothing else to figure out. It's just left with that image of soap. Okay, so I'll stop there.
Well, thank you for soaking us with the words and meaning of the koan. So, as I said, we have a little bit of time. We're not doing our usual temple cleaning. So, Douglas, please.
Yeah. I wanted to talk for a minute about the image of tempering and tempering.
Okay.
What God in tempering is not just in making swords, but in blacksmithing generally. And what you were trying to do is get the metal hot, make it hard, but also maintain the pliability.
Yeah, exactly. So hard, but the pliability.
Get the steel to a certain color, for example, which today we would know was a given temperature. And then you plunge it into cold water. Mm-hmm. Doing it at the right time meant the blade was be sharp and cut, but it wouldn't be brittle. If you did it incorrectly, it would break. And it wouldn't be a useful tool. And that's the sort of thing that I think that is going on in the koans all the time. There's the hot, cold, the hot steel and the cold water. There's always a juxtaposition. The teacher doesn't want you to get stuck on, you know, teaching by objects. It's fine to start, we all start with objects, and it takes that away one way or another. So I said, no, that's not it. But what is it? And then he comes, there's sort of an emptiness view. He's challenging that. It's not that, it's really something else. The different perspective. And as soon as the monk comes back and says, oh yeah, right, it's all emptiness. No, that's not it. He comes back, it is a thing. It is raindrops. It is the cypress tree in the garden, because that's the only place emptiness is.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely correct to say, I hear the raindrops, zillions of raindrops, but they're not raindrops, they're something, they're raindrops in a different context.
Yeah.
That's what he has to get the monk
to come up with.
But you can't formulate it as a view.
Right.
Because it's always, then you come up with some term, it's wholeness or something, which isn't it, that's a view. That's just entirely conceptual. It's not coming back to this open, intimate experience of this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's frequently hard in these to say, is it really, you know, that frequently it seems pretty clear that these students, even if they aren't masters, they understand what's going on, and it's a game. They're challenging each other. Who gets stuck? Who's going to express a view? Who's going to say it's objects? Who's going to say it's emptiness? And either one of those is wrong.
Great. Yeah, beautiful way to put it. And I think, you know, that's the turn. That's why he emphasizes just when you think you can't turn, you turn, because you're not going to get stuck. And the, you know, another... two other comments to that is, one is that he, in one of the cases, I can't remember the number, but he uses an interesting phrase you don't usually see, which is a piece of emptiness. Mm-hmm. So there's a very concrete word juxtaposed with emptiness that you're trying to, I guess, capture the middle way that, like, you're alluding to. And but also, let me point out something back in 45... that kind of, you know, reinforces what you're saying. And on page 273, on that column, in the middle there, it says, some people carried a load of chan to Jiaozhou's place, but when they got there, they couldn't make use of it after all. So that load is where you have the partial view that, you know, it's not going to, it has to get disrupted and destabilized. But then he goes on to say in the next paragraph, people these days all make unconcern or... and understanding. So unconcern. And that was a big debate back then and still is today. Unconcern literally means no thing, but not emptiness, but no thing in the sense of not dealing with actual things. In other words, that's the detachment view that he feels is deficient. So it was easy for people to say, "Well, look, if it's just the experience of the raindrops, then I have it. I don't need to practice. I don't need to get the satori. I don't need to make that developmental progress." And that's here in another example. That's I think the main deficiency that he wants to criticize.
Yes, another comment.
I have a question, and it's really more. I think I sort of fall on the, maybe we should burn these things, kind of, you know, I'm very sympathetic to that. And
the bonfire is going to start in a few minutes.
Yeah. And one of the reasons, I'd like to ask you, when you were talking about this paragraph on page 271, because that seems to present to me in a real concrete sort of way, and I don't disagree with anything you said about that paragraph. But it raises another question for me. And if I understood you correctly, the demonstration of Jiaozhou being able to always turn is his answer, I've never used objects to teach people.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that that actually the power of that answer does not in any way reside in the meanings of the words. It has to do with the way the words were deployed in the context of this very particular monk, particular time and place, and that's where its power comes from. One of my issues with koans is that context that can make us see why that is a powerful answer is not given, so far as I can tell. So it's almost like it invites us to start making up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is the question clear? I think this is a quality I often find in koans.
Right, and I think, yes, if I understand your question, I mean, I think that's a very good point. And I think the answer that I was,
you know, mentioning in a couple of examples like the 18 questions or the tempering, those tempering was that that's true because we're so distant from it. So in that context, they would have known. And in that historical setting where they were training and they were reading this stuff backwards and forwards, and probably memorizing it, and they had this vast ability to memorize because, again, you couldn't do Google searches or download. You know, the story of Dogen copying the stuff in one night and bringing it back, you know, if there is a productive demythology to that, it meant that in 4 years in China, Dogen memorized huge things that he could just cite verbatim, and that's been documented by the modern scholar. So I think that's what's missing. I don't think it's their fault. I think it's the fault of the history. Yeah.
Well, that raises the other question then. I mean, that I suspect that you're that's probably right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure. Well, you know, certainly there is, for all these stories, a context that we will just never have access to that could be taken for granted. But that automatically raises the question of whatever validity, you know, whether the guy should have burned it after it was produced or not, whether that was appropriate at the time. There's a question about what we can do with it now, not having that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to respond to that, okay. I was going to say that for us, looking at this material now, and I don't think that it's necessary to look at koans to do Zen practice, but if you are going to look at it, what we can do is then invent that. So in this particular story, what's the teaching that the teacher was trying to convey? And what was the who was the particular student and how were they relating to it? Which is why I sometimes recommend imagining a film scene and who would you cast, you know, in the different parts.
I'm sorry to labor the point, but if the meaning that the teacher is intending to convey is depending on the context,
yes.
How do we know we're not just kind of blowing smoke out of our ears?
Well, this is something we can talk about together, but part of our work on it, and this goes to things that Stephen's written about in terms of Dogen's approach to koans and elaborating on it, is to if you're going to look at this stuff, which again, you know, some of it is useful. Some stories may be useful to a particular person, and some stories may be forget about it. So you don't have to burn the whole thing. You can burn some, you know, just ignore the cases that don't speak to you. But also then, even the ones that do speak to you, what's the point that the teacher was making? What's the point that the student is questioning about? How do you see that? That's where it can be useful to some people, in my opinion. David.
I was thinking before, and I came to not what you said now, in power tempering, if I'm not mistaken, the part of it is it's not only to sharpen and make strong, it's for balance. That when a swordsman had a sword, he had to have the proper balance. If he didn't have the proper balance, he wouldn't be able to strike properly. And so part of it may be, like you're saying, with one student, it'll be one thing, with another student or another context, it'll be another. And it's a matter of us trying to understand the balance between those.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, another simple but I think important point is that in the end, there's human context. I mean, some of it was relative to Song China, which was, you know, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. And, all right, we'll never recreate that. But I think what happened was that they had a very, what I would call modernistic worldview back then. It was a period in China where people were very well educated. There was a meritocracy. There was kind of some beginning semblance of democracy. People had leisure time. They were spending that reading and writing and doing these cultural things. They had a very attractive environment that they could, you know, spend their leisure time contemplating nature and traveling to exotic places in the countryside. And very similar to some of what we do today when. You know, I mean, some of our leisure time is spent, you know, kind of foolishly in modern society. I'm sure they did some of that as well, but we have the time to reflect, and in those general human contexts, there's certain situations that are going to be repeatable, and you know, I think Hakuin, you know, was an example in the 18th century. He had the five categories of koan. So
people come along and say, all right, those old categories, maybe they don't work because we're not in touch with them, but let's recreate them. But I think the koans do touch on examples that are timeless.
Maybe on that note,
okay,
of timelessness, we'll take the time to close formally by reciting the four bodhisattva vows in your card. We'll cite them three times.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible.